Hey, everybody, and welcome to the Billboard Pop Shop Podcast. I'm Keith Caulfield, Senior Director of Charts at Billboard.
And I'm Katie Atkinson, Billboard's Executive Digital Director, West Coast.
Hi, Katie.
Hi, Keith.
We're actually physically in the same room.
We are indeed.
Well, then again, maybe we've been fooling people for the past few weeks.
Probably not, because we bring up all the time that we are in different countries, et cetera.
All right. I didn't mention the country thing until you
That
did.
Was me.
That was you. But that just means that this podcast is going to be even more spectacular.
That's correct.
Because it's going to be, the repartee is going to be so.
You can feel the energy in the room. You guys.
Yes, I can see it. It's in colors. That could just be the coffee. All right. Well, anyways, the Billboard Pop Shop Podcast is your one-stop shop for all things pop on Billboard's weekly charts. In addition, you can always count on a lively discussion about the latest pop news, fun chart stats and stories, new music, and guest interviews with music stars and folks from the world of pop. Today on the show, we've got chart news on how BTS celebrates its sixth number one album on the Billboard 200 chart with its retrospective compilation Proof, just as the South Korean pop group announced it was going on a hiatus. And how Joji charts his first top 10 and top 40 hit on the Billboard Hot 100 Songs chart with Glimpse of Us. And Carrie Underwood keeps up her streak of top 10 charting albums on the Billboard 200 as her latest effort, Denim and Rhinestones, marks her 10th consecutive top 10 album, which is the entirety of her charting efforts.
Go Carrie. Also on the show, we're breaking down what we know about Beyoncé's recently announced album Renaissance, due out on July 29th, plus our first impressions of the diva's just-released new song, Break My Soul. Also, Drake dropped a surprise album last Friday, Honestly, Never Mind, and the dance-leaning set could mark the superstar's 11th number one album on the Billboard 200. What do we make of the new direction for Drake's sound? We'll talk about that in a second. But first, before we get started, if you enjoy the podcast, subscribe to the show on your favorite podcast provider so you won't miss an episode. And if you want to explore more podcasts from Billboard, visit billboard.com/podcasts.
All right. Let's do the chart chat.
Well, that is a new cheer.
Come on, everybody.
Yeah.
Let's do the chat. The chat about the charts. It's the coffee, I'm telling you.
Oh,
it's
my
coffee.
God.
I'm on my second cup. All right, first up, BTS's new compilation album, Proof, debuts at number one on the Billboard 200 chart, garnering the pop group its sixth chart topper. The retrospective, don't call it a greatest hits, consisting mostly of previously released material, bows with 314,000 equivalent album units earned in the United States in the week ending June 16th, according to Luminate. The overwhelming majority of that unit figure was driven by CD album sales.
What year is it?
It's 2000?
I think so.
Imagine if BTS existed in the year 2000.
Oh, man.
Imagine them on TRL.
Oh, man. They were built for TRL.
Oh, my God.
Built.
They were just in the wrong time.
The wrong era.
The wrong era. Or the right era, depending on how you look
Correct.
At it.
Correct.
The anthology was released. Also, I want to point out, like I said, don't call it a greatest hits because they have not called it a greatest hits.
It's called an anthology album, and there are three brand new songs, one new song on each of the three discs. And then otherwise, the reason it's not exactly a greatest hits is because the members actually handpicked favorite things throughout the years that maybe are deep cuts or not so, you know, not the biggest ones that you all know.
And also it's easier to kind of not portray this as a greatest hits because there's actually legitimate hits missing off of it.
Correct.
Like My Universe isn't on it, and that was a number one hit with Coldplay.
Yep.
All right, well, the anthology was released on June 10th, just 4 days before the group announced an indefinite hiatus.
There's a lot of controversy around this word, Keith.
Well, is it because that? I saw that we did a story, then there was a lot of controversy around the word hiatus, but I was watching the video of BTS talking amongst themselves, and the translation at the bottom of the screen was the word hiatus. So
yeah.
Is that just bad translation?
That's what HYBE, the group that,
releases BTS music.
Yeah, they have said the translation. They have said it's not a hiatus. They're like, don't call it a hiatus.
Who translated the video?
Oh, I'm sure. Hybe? I'm sure somebody from their camp did, but I don't think that they
were.
Yeah, it's clearly a break.
Yeah.
It is clearly a pause. And so I think we're getting into semantics, but it's also, they're like a publicly traded company. So they're getting into semantics because if their biggest asset goes on a hiatus, that means their biggest asset is not earning them big asset money.
Their biggest asset's going to keep on earning assets.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Because they said they're going on the hiatus to focus on solo projects.
Right, yes. So they're going to focus on solo ventures because also I want to point out that this group has 7 members. They were formed in 2010, which I don't think a lot of people realize.
Yeah, I agree.
And they made their U.S. Billboard chart debut in 2013. And in the course of their career so far, they have tallied 15 entries on the Billboard 200 albums chart.
Wow.
Some more fun facts and details. Proof registers the year's biggest week for an album by a group, both in units earned and in album sales. And the only larger week overall this year was the debut frame of Harry Styles' Harry's House, mm-hmm. with 521,000 units, of which 330,000 were in album sales. I've yet to actually tell you how many copies that Proof has sold. I should probably do that. Hold on. Let me do that right now. Okay. So of Proof's 314,000 equivalent album units, album sales comprised 266,000. And of that number, about 259,000 were in CD album sales.
Wow. We actually just put an article up on Billboard.com about where to buy a CD player. That's something people need to know now.
So you might be wondering, why did the CD sell so well? Well, as is typical with many K-pop releases, the CD edition of the album was issued in elaborate collectible packages. There are 2 CD variants available in total. There's a $24 version and a $70 version. Specific retailers may have sale priced them for less, but it depends on where you bought it. Both have the same track list, just different packaging and internal paper goods, such as booklets and posters. Each version of the album also contains randomized elements like photo cards and postcards. There could be 1 of 7 different collectible photo cards, think like baseball cards, and you don't know which version of mm-hmm. the postcard or the photo card you're getting. So like if you really want RM and you get the album and you open it up and it's actually not RM on the photo card, maybe you go buy a second one mm-hmm. to see if you get the card you
maybe
want.
Maybe you do.
Pricey CD albums are not new for BTS. The act's last new studio album, which was 2020's B, was initially available in only 2 retail formats, a $9 digital album and a $50 CD.
Wow.
Yeah.
And wasn't there something that was available only on CD as part of this package?
The CD for Proof was the CD edition of Proof was 3 CDs, and the third disc, all but one of the tracks were exclusively available on the CD.
Right.
And it was mostly like demo recordings.
Right.
Whereas digitally and streaming, it was just the first 2 CDs.
Yeah.
Basically. So
if you wanted to hear that, you literally needed to buy the CD.
Until someone rips them and puts them on YouTube.
Well, fair enough.
I mean, I don't know.
So it's funny. It was only a couple of weeks ago that we talked about on the podcast what groups we wanted to get back together. And little did we know that BTS was about to announce their own hiatus. And obviously, we talked on that episode about a lot of these groups claiming they were on hiatus, but have been inactive for quite some time. So do we truly think that this is a hiatus for BTS, or that there's a world where BTS doesn't record more music together? I don't think there's a world where BTS doesn't make more music together.
I think what's going to happen is that the 7 of them are going to pursue individual projects and individual albums, and that we will continue to see repurposing and repackaging of their catalog of material. And who knows, maybe there's a live album from their recent stadium shows that has like a Blu-ray attached to it and like, you know, multi-camera views, 20 different views, pick the ones you want, but you don't know which one you're getting until you open the box.
But it is exciting because even before the break was announced, Lollapalooza announced that J-Hope would be a headliner by himself, just J-Hope. And so the writing was sort of on the wall there, because that has to be the biggest look, I would think, so far in the U.S. It is the first time that a K-pop act has headlined a U.S. Festival, one of the mainstream festivals. So there's an opportunity, there's a world where these seven individuals are going to go out and book a gig as big as headlining Lollapalooza by themselves. And they're all out there in the world doing massive things independent of one another. You know what I mean? So anyway, there's a lot to look forward to on that front for ARMY, I'm sure. But one of the things that Keith pointed out when we were putting this show together is that with BTS forming in 2010, they've actually been together for 12 years, which in the world of boy bands is quite lengthy.
Yeah.
When you start comparing it to some big groups like One Direction, who we spoke about on that show. They formed in 2010 on the X Factor UK, and then they went on their hiatus in January 2016.
And so at that point, they had already lost a member.
They'd already lost a member, and we're talking about under 6-year run with everything that they did. And then obviously, like, you know, their members have gone out and done individual things as well. NSYNC, who also have never truly broken up, they formed in 1995, and they put out their last release in 2002. That is, they have had like little things here and there since then, but they have been on hiatus for 20 years.
20 years.
I don't think BTS ARMY who are listening, I don't think you have to worry about a 20-year break between releases. But what about the Beatles, Keith? Talking about their longevity.
Their first single release was in 1961. They didn't have their big sort of American breakthrough until 1964, I believe. Mm. And then the group didn't really start to break up officially until mid-1970, when Paul McCartney left the group in April of 1970. And then they filed for the dissolution, or he filed for the dissolution of the partnership in December of 1970. So, you know, when you look at the span of time that the Beatles, like, you know, Paul, Ringo, and George were together, and then Ringo later joined. It was actually a fairly sizable amount of time. But in terms of what we knew of them in America, it was basically 64 to 70,
yeah,
which is a really short amount of time. Think of, like, how long were the Supremes together? It's like, well, they had their big breakthrough like in like 63, 64. They were together before then, but then they broke up at the end of 1969.
Yeah.
But we just think of these artists have been around for like a million years. Like, actually, they did a lot in a relatively short amount of time. Mm-hmm. I think the other thing that's kind of interesting to think about in terms of BTS is that a lot of the K-pop groups that we know are basically groups that were formed by sort of larger entities that are, you know, contracted with
whether
them.
It's a TV show or a company putting a group together, that's how it's, a lot of the K-pop groups form.
It's a very different kind of structure in how pop music is made and marketed in Korea. And so we don't, you know, so it's kind of like, think of it probably, it's similar to how acts are formed on reality television in America. One Direction probably had a contract. They were contracted for a certain amount of time, for a certain amount of work, and, you know, blah, just like Kelly Clarkson, when she won American Idol, she was contracted, you know, with Sony and her recording contract for a certain amount of time to give them a certain amount of work. These are things that people don't like to talk about because it makes you think of, like, oh, commercial things and contractual negotiations and business and art and commerce. I'm like, yeah, but it's
their businesses. These are businesses. I mean, I just talked about the BTS situation affecting the stock market in Korea.
Right.
You know, like, these are business operations.
So it'll be interesting to see what happens next. And, you know, the fact that they've been together for so long and have achieved so much. The fact that they want to try to do other stuff, I think that's expected. And I think also maybe, you know, they're looking at it going like, look how much bigger we could be if there's seven of us all creating music at the same time.
Totally.
Separately.
I mean, they're already wildly prolific, but now you got seven different entities out there releasing things.
Seven different stadium tours.
Exactly.
Think of it. All right. So should we move on maybe?
Yeah, I know somebody else who won American Idol, and her name is
not Jennifer Hudson.
No, she did not win.
As I got it wrong last week. Well, next up, Carrie Underwood keeps up her perfect streak of top 10 albums on the Billboard 200 as her new studio album, Denim and Rhinestones, bows at number 10. In total, it's her 10th top 10 album on the Billboard 200, the entirety of her charting efforts, stretching back to her 2005 debut album, Some Hearts. Did you know Some Hearts did not hit number one?
Oh, I didn't.
Debuted and peaked at number two behind Can you guess?
No.
Madonna's Confessions on a Dance
Floor. Oh, I should have known.
I mean, it's probably the reason why I can immediately think of it. Well, with the debut of Denim and Rhinestones at number 10, Carrie ties fellow country queen Reba McEntire for the most top 10 country albums on the Billboard 200 chart among female artists.
Wow.
You may think, but doesn't Taylor have a bunch? Yes, she does, but not all of those were technically
country
albums. All right, lastly, while Harry Styles, as it was, holds firm at number one on the Billboard Hot 100 Songs chart for a seventh week, Joji clocks his first top 10 hit. Heck, it's his first top 40 hit on the chart with the debut of Glimpse of Us at number 10. The track is heavily driven by its streaming activity as it bows at number 6 on the streaming songs chart with 18.3 million streams in its first week. The ballad is Joji's first release since his second album, 2020's Nectar. And last week, Billboard wrote about the track on Billboard.com, calling it, quote, worth the wait, end quote, and described it as a, quote, bare-boned, eye-watering ballad about hoping to find a glimpse of us in a new relationship, only to realize he's searching for something that's no longer there.
Well, isn't that poetic?
Yeah.
Is that from 10 Cool New Pop Songs this week?
It was. It was.
Check out that feature on Billboard.com.
I did my research and everything.
Well, 9 months after Certified Lover Boy, Drake delivered yet another new album, Honestly Nevermind, on Friday. For his seventh LP, Drizzy went against his typically very well-calculated ways to announce the surprise album just hours before it landed on streaming services. The last time he pulled a surprise release was for If You're Reading This, It's Too Late, back in 2015. Drake elected to keep his album shorter this time as well, 14 songs, which is small for a Drake album. The other surprise? It's a house album. He just did a whole dance album. None of these things were expected. And speaking of house, Beyonce also announced news of her, seventh album again, titled Renaissance, out July 29th. And on Monday, she dropped the very first song from the project called Break My Soul. And it's a house song. I'm just saying, like, what is going on? So, Keith, let's talk about these two superstars coming out of hibernation at the exact same time. And let's start with Beyonce's song, which came out late Monday night. So we're recording Tuesday morning, so we would have proper time to like digest this song. And I would happily love to start and just say it's so good. I love it so much. I immediately heard Big Frida's voice chanting at me, and the beat is just so good. It's such a throwback. It's so 90s. It is just, it's the poppiest song I think Beyonce's put out in a long time too. It, like, I can hear it on the radio, I can hear it on the dance floor. It's just a smash hit song to me. Keith, what were your thoughts when you heard it?
I wrote, well, now I need to go
revisit, like, your notes.
Yeah, like, I posted on Instagram last week. So when Beyonce announced the album last week, and then also announced that she was on the cover of British Vogue, I thought the photo shoot itself was perhaps giving clues as to what the album may sound like. One image of her is in sort of this silver number where she's like in sort of a floofy sleeved silver kind of aluminum foil thing with like some hot pants and big sort of thigh high silver boots. And she's on a light up dance floor, and I'm like,
oh, you're like, the dance album is coming.
I was like, she's channeling LaBelle, Hot Pants, Grace Jones, Saturday Night Fever. She has a light up dance floor. Another picture is of her. She's in mega platform glitter boots sitting atop a huge disco ball. And I said, if these photos are any indication of the actual music on the album, this could actually be really dance-tastic. And this first single is very throwback house music, house pop dance music from the 90s. Like, you know, this would completely fit in with like a Robin S. Show Me Love.
Robin S., Crystal Waters. Like, it's just giving all the 90s house, and I'm loving it.
Right. It's, and it also, I think, after a number of projects from Beyonce that were very, I think people would position them as serious and
artistic
and adventurous. I think this is very just footloose and fancy free, pop dance,
yes,
Beyonce. And it's, I think it's probably been a moment where we've had this kind of Beyonce single.
Well, and I mean, she says it right in the lyrics, like, you know, we're back outside. And I feel like she was like, we've been holed up, like, forget my art for a second. Let me just make a joyous song, album, et cetera. I mean, we'll find out what the album sounds like.
Right. This could be the one.
Exactly. Sort of it could be a track. Total standout.
Everything else is balanced.
Totally. But but like she says right there in the lyrics, like, we are back outside. And it's like, oh, yeah, she's like taking us outside. She's putting us in the club. And I love the entire thing. I'm so excited for what the rest of the album is going to sound like after hearing this. And I also feel like, you know, she hasn't had a number one on our Hot 100 since Single Ladies was her last number one.
Wow.
So that was a long time ago. And also perhaps arguably the last time she put out what might be considered like a dance song. I mean, that's like a dance floor filler at a wedding. It's not like it's an EDM song or something, but it's a dancey song.
Right.
And it feels like that's definitely a formula that works for Beyonce. Like, she just made a pop hit, in my opinion. And so it'll be interesting to see if our charts reflect like that it is as popular as it sounds like it could be, you know?
Right.
So we shall see. But back to Drake for a moment. He did not put out a rap album. This is
Katie's opinion.
This is a dance album. This is totally my opinion. I feel like people were like, at least people I saw on social media, we're weirdly like surprised by this album more than I would have expected they should be, because this sound is not foreign to Drake. I mean, it actually had a lot of like the Afrobeat sounds he pulls from. It had like, it actually made me think specifically of the song Passion Fruit from More Life, which was a minor hit. It wasn't a huge hit for Drake, but it was like a radio song single. And I loved that song. And this album to me sounds like it's a full album just of Passion Fruit. Like, that's what it sounds like to me. And I loved Passion Fruit. Therefore, I think this album is amazing. And this is what I would choose if I could, like, you know, if I could, you know, put Drake on a course. This is the course that I would have put him on. And it seems like I don't know if that's a popular opinion, because it sounds like other people might have kept him on a little bit more of a hip hop, rap, trap course, etc., than how I like my Drake. But Keith, what have you been seeing out there? Or what do you think of this dance Drake?
This isn't too far away from kind of the rhythmically up-tempo kind of beat-driven songs that we've heard in the past from him. If you only know big Drake hits, think, okay, One Dance and Hotline Bling.
Yeah.
Imagine if you just had an album that was mostly those kind of sonics, but maybe a little bit leaning more into house. And I was talking to Katie Bain, who's our dance director, and I was asking her her thoughts on it. And she was pointing out how Drake worked with a lot of sort of left of field kind of dance producers on this. So it wasn't like he was working with his typical crew of people and they were like mimicking what house music should sound like or dance music should sound like. He was going out of his way to work with people from the dance world.
Yeah. There's a great, Katie did a great article on Billboard that it's like six dance artists that Drake worked with on this album. So check that out if you want some more information on those credits.
Who do we want a dance album from now? Taylor Swift?
Well, that's the shocking part of this, like the timing of it all. And I mean,
I wonder if Beyonce and Drake talk to one another, be like, yo.
I mean, it feels like Jay-Z's like the common link between these two, but I don't know if like Jay-Z and Drake are so close that like Drake's playing music for Jay-Z early and then
You know who would have heard Drake's album? Adele.
Oh, because right?
Because they're like BFFs.
Okay, that's possible.
Because Drake heard Adele's album a long time
ago.
And
she's Beyonce's number one fan.
What? Was there like a dinner party with like Beyonce, Jay, Drake, and Adele?
Everyone was like, let's do dance now, guys.
Like, they all pulled out their like cassette boom boxes and put them on the table.
Should dance be the move next?
Like,
the timing is wild.
Stadium tour with Adele, Beyonce, and Drake together. I don't know why. It's the coffee. I'm telling
and
you.
And it was funny too because, you know, Beyonce made the first move of announcing when Renaissance would come out, but then Drake dropped the surprise album like hours after her announcement. Yeah. And then it's like, oh, okay, so they won't conflict because he put the whole album out now, except for the song is now out. So my next question is, because we were talking about the chart prospects for Beyonce, like, what, you know, could she get back to, you know, her next number one since Single Ladies? But also Drake could potentially, I mean, when Drake puts out an album, he frequently goes to number one with a song from that album.
Yeah, I do. Yeah, I wonder. I think it looks like the track that is kind of, at least initially, gaining the most attention was actually the most conventional track on the album, the one with, I think, 21 Savage on it. Is that the one I'm thinking of, the very last track on the album?
Well, that's not the one that I've been seeing, like, on my streaming, like, my playlist, though. The one that's been playlisted has been, one moment. Okay, so Falling Back is the one that has been playlisted for me. But to your point, Jimmy Cooks seems to be the one that is, has some heat behind it, yeah, which is the 14th track on the album.
Yeah, the one that basically just sounds like a typical Drake rap song.
Okay, well, there you go.
So, I mean, we'll see. Well, I mean, I don't know. Does this mean he's going to have like 10 of the top 10 on the Hot 100?
Or it might not be a release like that, though, no, which is maybe why he decided on the surprise release, because he wasn't trying to, you know, to bake, like, get the motive or the momentum all, like, worked up, because he knew this wasn't that kind of album.
Yeah, it's,
you know,
like when Taylor did Folklore, it's like, well, you better, like, sort of change your expectations on what this is going to be, because maybe people won't receive this in sort of a typical huge fashion. And if Drake is doing something that is a little bit left of center for him, then it may have a, it may react differently.
But it does feel likely that it would debut at number one on the Billboard 200 albums chart.
Look, I just assume that it would,
right,
because it's Drake.
Yeah.
And Drake normally has number one albums.
Yeah.
Kind of like you assume that Beyonce will be number one with her album. I don't even know what's on it. You just assume that it will be.
And even if this isn't the Drake fans' cup of tea, they gave it a curiosity listen, if nothing else.
Right. Now, I mean, yeah, I haven't looked at sort of the daily streams and if it's just fallen off a cliff since Friday or Saturday.
I'm still listening, Keith.
Maybe this is more up your alley than a typical Drake album.
I think it is.
I don't know. It will be interesting to see as we talk about Beyonce. You know, she, like, you know, does this, is this song, because it's more sonically kind of poppy, dancey, mainstream-ish, and sort of joyful, does that mean that it's going to be like be immediately embraced by radio and streaming playlists? People are going to add it to their own personal playlist. Mm-hmm. It's going to be like a big summer anthem.
Oh, I mean, God, I want to hear this on the beach. Yes, yes.
Like, I want to hear it on the beach, at home, with the kids, going to work.
Did you think about quitting your job at Billboard after listening to it? Release your job. Release your trade. Really, just dying over the whole song is so good. And I feel like we should do a list of songs that is about, like, it's like really rich people doing songs about, like, your job being really hard. Like, oh, I have to do that 40-hour a week job. I gotta quit this job. They work me too hard. It's like, Beyonce, when did you ever work? Like, we weren't at, like, Orange Julius when you were, like, in high school.
Hey, we don't know how difficult it is to be Beyonce and work as hard as she does.
Very true. But she's writing it in the context that will be relatable to her fans.
Right.
You know, she's writing it as if she's, like, working in an office or something. It's hilarious to me. I love it.
All right. Well, now it's time for the chart stat of the week. Years ago, Whitney Houston's I Want to Dance with Somebody, parenthetical, who loves me, hit number one on the Hot 100, her fourth of 11 number ones. The joyful track, there's that word again, jumped 3-1 on the chart dated June 27th, 1987, and spent 2 weeks atop the list. The song was an instant smash hit, debuting at number 38 on the May 16th, 1987 chart. At the time, that was the highest debut in nearly 2 years. Back then, it wasn't frequent that a song would debut in the top 40, owed to how the chart itself was compiled and how music was consumed. You know, it was very difficult for a song to have coast-to-coast instant success because media just didn't work the way it does today.
Correct.
Fun fact, of the 90 songs that had previously debuted in the top 40 of the chart, before I Want to Dance with Somebody. A full 40% of them eventually reached number one.
Wow. So, huge indicator of a hit.
It was a pretty sensible thing to assume Whitney, who had already had three number ones to her credit, would likely sail to number one with I Want to Dance with Somebody, following its top 40 debut. The song was the lead single from Houston's second album, the simply titled Whitney. The set would make history as the first album by a woman to debut at number one on the Billboard 200 chart, and only the fifth album overall to do so. The next album by a woman to debut at number one would not come until 1993, when Janet Jackson's Janet album opened atop the list. The Whitney album would generate a total of five top 10 hits on the Hot 100, four of which hit number one. In addition to I Want to Dance with Somebody, she also topped the chart with Didn't We Almost Have It All?, So Emotional, and Where Do Broken Hearts Go?
What an album.
I know. Just nothing but hits. Those first two albums are just basically greatest hits albums on their own.
Also, every time you hear a Whitney song title, you just want to sing it. Like,
oh, I know.
Didn't We Almost Have It All really did it to me. I just wanted to break into it.
Where do broken hearts go? All right, so there you have it. 35 years ago this week, I Want to Dance with Somebody Who Loves Me hit number one on the Hot 100. We've reached the end of our show. Do you have any parting words, Katie? Because I have some parting words.
I would love to hear your parting words, Keith.
Well, I want to mention the passing of Joel Whitburn.
Oh, yes.
He was a landmark chart historian and founder of Record Research. He died last week at the age of 82. Before there was Wikipedia, before there was Twitter accounts dedicated to chart statistics, before there were chart managers like me, before there was Billboard.com, well, there probably were chart managers back in the day, but before there was, like, you know, Billboard.com chronicling every move on the charts, there was Joel. He was a man who turned his hobby, his love for music charts, into a business. He launched his first book dedicated to the minutiae of the charts. It was called Top Pop Singles in 1970. These were research books to some dry, stats-driven, sort of huge, sort of encyclopedia-type things that were basically reference materials. To others, like me, they were like holding the history of charted popular music in your hand. Joel and Billboard cut a licensing deal in 1970 for the exclusive publishing rights to mine the Billboard charts, and it's a deal that continues to this day. For decades, truly the only way most people knew where anything peaked at on the charts was thanks to the bookkeeping and research that Joel and his company did. Also, he apparently coined the phrase peak position.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. This was all pre-internet and pre-computers. If you wanted to confirm how well something did on the charts, you checked the Whitburn books. Literally, everyone who owns the Record Research books, and there are now hundreds of them, counting reprints and updated volumes, calls them the Whitburn books. His name is on the spine of basically every one of them. Today, my desk at Billboard has 30 different Whitburn books that I regularly reference when researching information for the stories that I write, and all of the assistance that I provide the editorial staff at Billboard when they are researching information for their stories about the charts. In a statement, Billboard's SVP of Charts and Data Development, Silvio Pietrolongo, said, "Billboard could not have asked for a better representative to document the history of our charts than Joel Whitburn. His passion and innovation led to the creation of what is literally the encyclopedia of music popularity, Record Research, without which the Billboard team and most in the industry would be hard-pressed to provide the historical context that we do on a daily basis." So
that's nice.
We'll miss you, Joel, and we love everything that you did, and we love everything that your company will continue to do.
Absolutely.
I think when I was in high school, I bought, Rhino Records put out compilation albums that were basically based upon his research, and they were branded Billboard Top Hits, you know, presented by Joel Whitburn. Mm. And it was like the top hits of 1980. Like I had the one for 1980, 1981, 1982, 1983. And I thought it was fascinating and I loved it. And then I think I bought, I think my first Whitburn book I bought with my own money as a high school student. They were kind of expensive back in the day. They still are expensive. And I was just so fascinated by it. And then, you know, I started to buy books that Fred Bronson, of course, mm-hmm. wrote, you know, our former Chartbeat editor. And then, you know, I discovered that Billboard had all these charts and, you know, just set, you know, Joel's books sort of made people like me just light up, you know, yeah. inside, which I know sounds ridiculous, but there are many, many more people like me that love the Billboard charts and love Joel's books.
It was really nice to see the outpouring of love on Twitter last week when we shared the sad news. Gary actually, in his mailbag article, wrote a little bit about people's responses to the news. And you are not alone in idolizing him, yeah. for sure.
I never got to meet Joel in person. Oh. I talked to him on the phone a few times. Mm-hmm. But Silvio and Gary had met him in person mm-hmm. before, and I think they went to even like a baseball game with him at some point
cool.
when he visited the New York office a few years ago. So anyway, I thought as we close out the show, I thought I was reading through some previous interviews with Joel, and he did an interview with Gary Trust, my equivalent in New York. He did an interview with Gary Trust a number of years ago, and Gary was asking him about his favorite music and his favorite artists, and he mentioned that his all-time favorite girl group was the Shirelles.
Aww.
And I thought we could go out on one of the Shirelles' number one hits, which was Will You Love Me Tomorrow, their number one from 1961.
I love that.
So we're going to go out on that, and we'll see you guys next time.
Bye.